the date of February 7, 2007, and we have invited testimony tonight, I believe. Our topic is transparency reporting on cost and quality, and I believe our first individual up is Judy Hibbard. Judy, would you come forward and identify yourself, please?
Yes, I'm Judith Hibbard from the University of Oregon.
While she's setting up the committee, tonight we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to have some testimony here, and then the last half an hour, we want to talk about where we're going the next couple of weeks and thereafter. We want to start, as we say, putting some meat on the bones. We're going to have, starting next week, we're going to start looking very carefully at some actual plans and what those plans might look like coming out of 329. So we will have to start that conversation tonight and carry on to next week. Judy, you ready?
Yes.
Please proceed.
Okay. Well, thank you for inviting me here tonight.
Give me your name for the record, where you're from.
Judith Hibbard from the University of Oregon.
Thank you.
I understand that you've been hearing about healthcare quality transparency. So I want to talk to you a bit about what we know about this. You've probably heard that there's a lot of good things that can come out of making the quality information public. Consumers can make better decisions, can choose higher quality hospitals and physicians, and it can also stimulate providers to be more motivated to improve the quality of care that they provide. It also can mean real accountability for healthcare providers. And it can increase the public's understanding of what high-quality health care is. And then hopefully it can also increase competition on quality so that health plans and providers will compete on quality. So that's kind of the good news. The not-so-good news is that public reports on health care quality have not always yielded all of these good things. And that's primarily because consumers have not really paid attention and used quality information in their choices. And probably this is because most of the reports that have been made available to consumers haven't really been understandable, and they're very difficult to use. And instead of telling you lots about it, I'm just going to show you. So here's an example of a one page out of a 50-page report on hospital quality.
Excuse me. Can we turn the lights down half a notch?
So you can see. Good idea.
Yeah. Do you have a handout of this by chance?
I think they're making them, yes. So you have to keep in mind, what is the consumer's job here? The consumer's job is to figure out what is the best hospital. But when you have a report that's 50 pages long and it's covering several different indicators of quality, what you have to do is keep that information in your mind as you go from page to page to try to then bring it all together and figure out which is the best hospital. It's sort of impossible for any human being to do this. And if we look at the actual quality indicators that are there, they include things like length of stay and readmissions. So maybe you know, or maybe you don't know, is it better to have a lower length of stay or a higher length of stay? Is that higher quality? The report designers thought that a lower length of stay was better quality. But for consumers who've been in managed care, they might think that a longer length of stay is better because the plan let them stay when they needed to. And the same with the idea of readmissions. Readmissions are supposed to be an indicator of poor quality because why did they need to come back into the hospital? But consumers might not understand that and think that that is also an indicator of good quality because they were allowed to go back to the hospital when they needed to. So here's a quality report that doesn't really it's not really clear what's good and what's not good. And this is one of the reasons that consumers have not really used these reports to the degree that they could. Here's another example of a report where there's lots of small differences here, but the consumer is left to figure out, well, really, what is a meaningful difference? And probably because the report designers didn't know, and so they just put the data out there and said, well, let's let consumers figure it out. Maybe that's not the best approach. Here's another example of a difficult report to understand that has confidence intervals, which is kind of an advanced statistical concept that most consumers don't know about and probably don't really want to learn about it. So these are some of the reasons that public reports have not really delivered on the promise that it, or at least what everyone hoped they would do. We did some studies at the university to see, well, what would help consumers use information and make better healthcare choices. We did laboratory studies, and we found that there were a number of ways that you could help people, and they were primarily by essentially summarizing the information and interpreting it, making it easier, so people didn't have to work so hard to figure out what this means. Here's an example of a report that people could understand. This was a report that that an employer coalition in Wisconsin put together, and it used a lot of strategies that were made it very easy to understand by highlighting the high performers, by using symbols that people could understand, etc. We actually had an opportunity to evaluate the impact of this report on hospital quality improvement and on consumers. I'm going to share with you just the highlights of that study. So this was the report that went out to consumers in an area of Wisconsin. Turned out we had the same data on the hospitals for all the hospitals in the state. So we randomly assigned the ones that weren't in the Alliance service area, the employer coalition area, to get a private confidential report on their own performance or to get no information, but we did know what their performance was. And so we followed the hospitals, and we also looked at the impact on consumers over time. So I'm just going to give you the highlights of that. We looked at, does quality improvement efforts did we see more within the public report group? And to what degree do private reports actually stimulate quality improvement? And our public reports, do they stimulate more? And did we see actual improvements in care? And how did it affect consumers? Those were our research questions. 9 months after the release of the report, we looked at the hospitals and looked at their quality improvement efforts. And as you can see, the hospitals in the public report were doing more in quality improvement in the area where there was low quality. The private report hospitals were doing about in between the no report and the public report hospitals. Whoops.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I may ask a question. What are the numerical values in your scale?
In there?
Uh-huh.
Those are the average number of quality improvement activities that the hospital reported that they were engaged in.
Thank you.
Can I follow up my question? I was thinking the same thing. Is this is after the reports came out?
This is nine months after.
Is this the change or is this the number?
No, this is just the absolute number. And we're comparing the three groups that had a private report, no report.
Prior to the public report, what were the levels all roughly the same in the twos? And this made a dramatic change in their activity?
We didn't actually measure prior, but we did look at actual improvements after. So from baseline.
Okay.
So,
Mr. Chair, what would constitute an improvement activity? I mean,
So they were doing quality improvement around lacerations after delivery. This is all in obstetrics. reducing hemorrhage.
I see those, but what would constitute an improvement? And it sounded like they were, to get a number there, all they had to do is be involved.
That's right.
In an improvement.
That's right.
But you have results of this.
We have also the actual quality improvement.
That's where
so
you
they
are
were.
Right.
They were working at it. We saw 9 months after. And we saw that those who had the lowest scores were doing the most activities. And then we went back 2 years later and we actually looked at the same data source that we got the original data from. And we looked at, these are the percent of hospitals with significant improvements or declines in their performance in the post-report period. So what you see is that the public report hospitals were much more likely to improve. The private report hospitals were somewhat more likely to improve. And the no report hospitals were as likely to decline in their performance as improve in their performance. So we did see, again, that the hospitals that said they were doing the most actually were the ones who were improving. And this is the same data for just the hospitals who started out with poor scores, where we see that in the public report hospitals, they were doing quite a lot. Now, we asked the hospitals also in the original survey, is this report likely to affect your public image? And the hospitals in the public report condition who had good scores said, yes, it will enhance our public image. And those who had poor scores said, yes, it'll detract from our public image. They felt that it would affect their public image, at least those in the public report condition. We asked the same question about market share, and there we did not see a difference. Didn't matter what group they were in or what their performance was. And, in fact, when we looked at the data, we did not see that it affected their market share.
Let's back to that again just for a second. Whether or not they improved or did not improve, whether they scored well in the public report or not, did not affect their market share.
It did not. But it affected their perception that they their public image was at risk.
But did not affect the public.
It did not affect their, and I'll say more about that if you want in a minute. Okay, so it was all about their reputation. And so we looked at what impact did this have on consumers. And we did see over a two-year period that the impact of the report did change people's views about which were the better hospitals in the community. So what we found, and this is just high level, if you want more detail, I can give you lots, that public reporting had a greater impact on quality outcomes than private reporting, just privately knowing what your performance is. It also had an impact on consumers' views and their choices. But the impact we observed was primarily via their concern about protecting their public image. Now, if you remember back to the examples of the reports that I showed you, most public reports out there would not either threaten or enhance anyone's public image because no one can figure them out. So the point is that public reporting can work if it's done in a way that is sensitive to consumers and that that consumers can understand, even if they don't act on it, at least immediately. So I guess one of the key lessons is that just making the data available may not be enough. And one of the lessons that we learned in all of this, and that has been played out many times across the country, that the things that help consumers the most in using this information are the things that are resisted the most by providers. So politically, it's difficult to do what we're suggesting here.
Can I ask a couple questions here on this?
Yes.
One of the things that concerns me about the system is that consumers really don't have a choice in many cases. They have either one hospital in their community, or their choice of a hospital is not made by the consumer, but by the physician who refers them to the hospital. And I think that might have more to do about market share than the report. I'm glad these hospitals responded to the report, and they were concerned about their public image. I hope they responded. I would have hoped they would have responded just as well to the private report. Clearly, they didn't.
They didn't.
And that's very unfortunate here. It means they only responded because the light of day was shown upon them, which is
exactly.
Which is kind of embarrassing. And more than embarrassing, it's kind of sad. But I would think that if consumers really had a choice in these areas, they might say, I do not want to go to that hospital. So on these hospitals, you know enough about them? Were they hospitals in one town? There was no choice? What was going on here?
This is what I found out after all of this played out, that Wisconsin is a pretty unique market, and there is a very strong alliance between the hospitals and the physicians, and that means that physicians only practice at one hospital. And so even though consumers, and we did ask them if they thought they had choices, but in reality they didn't, because they would have had to change doctors to change hospitals, and that is a very unlikely occurrence. So the things that in retrospect I think motivated the hospitals were they were all nonprofits. They raised money in the community. They cared about how the community viewed them. They have a board of directors that might direct them in different ways if they're publicly embarrassed. So there are reasons that, besides immediate market share, in addition to those relationships with physicians and maintaining them, is how they maintain their market share. And if physicians are unhappy with them, that would threaten their position as well. So it's not quite as direct as I thought at first. And you know, there's actually a lot of similarities between Wisconsin and Oregon. There's a lot of rural small hospitals and a lot of nonprofit, not parts of chain hospitals here. So I'm just going to finish here by saying that this can work, but in order to make it work, we have to keep in mind the consumer at every step in the process, what we measure, how it's displayed, how to disseminate and promote reports. Thank you.
Any questions?
But having said what you just said, and then you say, which I understand. I mean, it was the public image and the reputation in the community that was really the motivator here, and you have privileges. One physician has privileges at this hospital, but not the next. So it was really the public image motivator. And believe me, all of us sitting behind this dais understand the public image quotient. But then at the very end you say, but we've got to keep the consumers in mind as we do this. And I don't disagree with that, but can you flesh that out a little bit more? Because that seems to be going like, it's not the consumers.
No, it is the consumers. Because if you put out a report that consumers cannot understand, they cannot figure out, none of the providers are worried about it, because who can figure it out? So it really has to speak to consumers, even if they don't act. And consumers have to pay attention for the provider community to care. So it has to be something that addresses issues that they care about, and it has to be something they can understand for this whole transparency thing to work.
Senator Morris?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are some quality metrics that are being used in hospitals today. Have you looked at those, and would you have recommendations? What I'm struggling with is, this is good information. It's kind of that foundation now. What do we build on top of it? It goes beyond our expertise to craft the appropriate metrics. How do we get to that point?
Yeah. There are a lot of measures out there that are quite particular. And unfortunately, that's kind of where a lot at the national level where they started. But I think for consumers, it's would help to have cross-cutting measures. That is, if I go into the hospital, what's my chance of having an infection? You know, this is something that could happen. I have no control over, and it's, you know, a bad thing that can happen. And it doesn't matter what I'm going into the hospital for. It could happen to anyone in the hospital. So cross-cutting measures that could speak to anyone and give a person a sense of, you know, how safe is it to be in this hospital. What we found in the survey with consumers was that we asked them about, you know, have you been in the hospital in the last year, or your family member, or you think you will be in the next year? And that was unrelated to their use, their looking at the report, which told me that people are interested in the quality of the institutions in their community, just like they want to know about what are the good schools and good restaurants. So if we make a report that they can come away with an impression like that, I think consumers will be interested.
Follow up? Are you familiar with the Prescani system?
That's the patient experience surveys.
Those. Do you have any reflections on the kinds of programs that would be worthwhile to actually require standardization of implementation?
Yeah, actually the federal government has developed a series of survey instruments called the CAPS instruments that are used to measure patient experience. So in the hospital, in nursing homes, with physicians, a whole family of measures that are standardized, and there's a standardized approach to how you collect the data and report it. So this is an important piece of the picture, people's experiences in what happens to them, but it's not the whole picture.
All up in.
Well, I mean, my takeaway from this, and this makes sense to me, is that, okay, you've got to get to quality measures that consumers can understand. Fine. But at the end of the day, it's really a combination of understandable measures and public image, public reputation of the institution, in this case the hospital, that is working in tandem. Is that a fair assessment of what you just said?
I think so. You have to have something that they want.
So it's easily readable and,
right,
you know,
and they can understand it. Yes. So that if you don't get people there, then no one cares about you know, their reputation, because they know that no one's looking.
But even if it's a public report,
yes,
and the consumers can't understand it, I'm not saying that's a good thing. What I'm also hearing you say is that the medical community and maybe the movers and shakers and opinion makers in a community, you know, get word and get drift and get sense that, hey, our hospital isn't doing as good as it should, even though average consumer looking at this report can't understand the first word on it. The pillars of the community, the guys that donate to the new cardiac ward and the new birthing center, they get it. And so hospitals are still motivated to improve.
Yes, they may still be. But you probably aren't getting the full value.
That I understand.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, I guess I'm... it would be easy, I guess, in this example, Mr. Chair, we're giving folks credit in a public way of doing things to improve. And which is, I mean, in any of this, do we get to the bottom line of there are less incidents because of the improvements? I mean, that would be something that I think would be more real. But that wasn't what on any of your slides, was it?
No, there was. There was actual improvements.
Okay.
There were fewer, in this case, hemorrhages and adverse events during a delivery.
Okay, it gets back, Mr. Chair, to the one slide that showed less deaths than normal, yeah. Sort of thing, which I understand that sort of stuff.
A bit of an oxymoron. That
stuff sort of happens. I guess to a degree, if you're going to be taking that sort of information out to the public and saying, you know, our hospital is really doing good because we had 20 less serious staph infections this month. And you know, I don't see how you get a good positive spin in the public on getting to that sort of detail. But it
but it moves you in the right direction. Professor, a couple of questions real quick, if I could. One is that did you ever consider, or has it been considered, to use what I consider something that most people understand, the Consumer Reports way of rating things? Because they rate different products with a scale that most of the people in this room have probably looked at when they went to buy a car or appliance or a TV set or whatever. Was there a consideration ever of using something that's already known to the public and is somewhat meaningful to them?
Many reports do use the Consumer Reports, but actually it's not that well used by consumers except in a particular SES group. So when you go to people who have less education and maybe less income, they have less experience with things like Consumer Reports. So you really want something that's inherently meaningful to everyone without even a key that they can get the meaning from the symbols.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest, though, that for some populations, everything is going to be somewhat Greek, and although a lot of people may not really look at Consumer Reports, most people have heard the term. And so, I mean, you're by going to where the good chair spoke, at least you're going into a modality that they can relate to, and something like that might be positive.
I agree. What I do take away from this, though, is that transparency, although it doesn't work the way we'd expect it to or hoped for it to work, it did, in fact, work in this particular case. The transparency does have obvious and real value here. It may not work the way we wanted to, but at least it worked. Good Senator Westland has handed, or this is from Frank? No, I think Frank's point is well taken. He says what we need is a statewide standardized reporting system that meets the criteria of this presentation. I think, Frank, you're absolutely right. And if you had I'll editorialize for a minute, if you had a board that was in position to review this on a statewide basis, we could probably start looking at a matrix that covered the entire state, was uniform and meaningful to people across the state. And I think that's what you're probably talking about.
I think that's exactly right. And some at the national level are talking about this, but they haven't arrived there yet. But I think that's very astute.
How long have they been talking about it?
How long have we been talking about health care reform?
All time is now.
In this committee, it's somewhat less than that time, and we plan to move it forward rather quickly, I think. Any other comments or questions? Yes.
Thank you, Senator. I've sat quietly through a little bit of testimony tonight, and then also on Monday night around transparency. And it's been a very curious subject to me, and I just want to underscore something that Senator Bates said about it. I guess if I go from personal experience, this is all quite theoretical, because in my relatively short adult life so far, I don't feel as if I've had a lot of choice with respect to providers, hospitals, services. Now, there are reasons for that, my relatively short adult life, the fact that I haven't had severe medical complications that have required me to seek services. But I think it really is worth sort of underscoring the sort of question that you raised about the value of this. I can certainly see in an abstract and theoretical way, and now actually real way, the value of transparency around quality and cost. But boy, as a consumer of medicine, you know, I haven't actually had a lot of choice. I just want to sort of put that on the record and recognize that that really should underline a lot of the conversation that we have around this. This
thank topic. You, Representative Kahn. You're right.
Well, I guess I would ask you, and we can talk about later, is why you feel you don't have a choice. I mean, and I'd like to talk about that because that's.
Well, the lack of choice is for many reasons, sometimes only one hospital, but as far as selecting a physician, if most of us think about it, if you move to a new town and you want to select a physician, what do? You ask a friend, you know, who's a good doctor. And that's what it happens. And I would offer that's not the best way to pick a physician.
Well, and all due respect, a lot of practices are closed as well. And
well
so
there's another lack of choice.
Right, right. Right.
Professor, thank you very much this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you for spending your time with us here. Next up is Nancy Clark. Could you give us your name and address for the record, please?
My name is Nancy Clark. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation. I'm delighted to be here today.
Could you take a second and tell us about the Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation just for a moment?
I would be delighted to.
Yeah, Judy, by the way, you were welcome to sit.
Chair Bates, Chair Westland, and distinguished members of the Healthcare Reform Committee, I'm delighted to be here today, and I thank you for inviting me to testify. The Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation is a multi-stakeholder nonprofit. We have representation from health plans, from physicians, from hospitals, from purchasers, and from consumers. And we are an organization. Our mission is to improve the quality of healthcare through collaboration, and we find opportunities when the various stakeholders want to put aside their competition and work together to get something done, and that's what we do. So I'm delighted to talk to you about our ideas around quality, data transparency, and healthcare reform. What I'd like to do is, if I may, is just start with a little personal experience that maybe you can relate to. I have the fortune of about once a month to drive from Portland over to the very far eastern corner of the state. And as I do that, I pass about 6 billboards usually that tell me where I should get my healthcare. And there's one about halfway that always intrigues me. It says, not all big city cancer doctors, or it changes the kind of doctor, but not all big city doctors are in the big city. And that always gets my imagination going, because I guess there's an implication that there's something good about big city doctors, and somehow if you take them out of the big city and put them in a little city, you still got good care. And my imagination just starts running, you know, well, if I had cancer, you know, well, how would I choose? Should I go to the big city, or should I go to the little city? Should I stop halfway in between? Unfortunately, in Oregon right now, that billboard is about the best information you've got about the quality of cancer doctors and how you would make your choice. And so the Quality Corporation is very much working on how do we get past that, how do we move toward the sort of work that you heard about on Monday night and that you just heard from Professor Hibbard. So what I would like to do is talk about how does quality data transparency fit in health reform, what's the Quality Corporation doing about it, and what are our thoughts and recommendations around policy reform related to this. And please interrupt me. You know, I'm happy to answer questions and make sure that this meets your needs. I would start with just a couple of facts. I know you all don't want to dwell on the problem, but I just want to make sure everybody knows this is not like woe begone. We're not all above average. In fact, if you look at an overall measure of healthcare quality in Oregon, comparing states, we're average, and we're actually getting just a slightly worse. And of course, as you know, from the United States, even average is not that good, as well as it could be when compared to other nations. And particularly, I will just mention that in the area of chronic care, chronic disease, which is where we spend a lot of our energy, you know, people only get the correct care about 55% of the time. So we've got a lot of improvement that we could do. But there's one fact that I want to be sure everybody is thinking about, and that is behind average is a lot of variation. We have lots of pockets of excellence, and we have some pockets of not so good much excellence. And it's not all in one clinic. One clinic can be very good on one thing and not so good on another. I just grabbed this out of a wonderful document called the Dartmouth Atlas, and what they do is look at a really detailed level, community level, around how does care vary. And I just happened to grab one. This is about ICU days in the last 6 months of life or the last 2 years of life. And you can see that there's a big variation behind the state average, that in Bend, in the last 6 months of life, you're going to spend about a day in the ICU, and in Salem, you'd spend almost 3 days. Now, there could be lots of reasons for this. I'm not saying one is better quality than the other, but it makes you say, why is the practice different? Why is there variation there? Shouldn't we be studying that and understanding why that variation is there? Because there's certainly a difference in cost. And that's why I think we want to think about this variation so much. That, you know, you have to ask the question, are there differences in safety and quality of health care across the providers? And if there's not any difference, then we can just buy on price. And all we have to do is get access and do the financing piece. But if there is variation, we need to do more than just look at price. We need to also talk with our consumers about what is the variation in the quality. We need to figure out ways to reward excellence. We need to find ways to encourage improvements and do some remeasurement. So it's important to know where the variation is and act on that. Yes?
Could you go back one slide, please?
Uh-huh.
Maybe two. Yes, that slide. This is extremely important. And the piece that's not here is, and I assume it's probably not any differences, mortality and morbidity figures for these same populations. And I would wonder if they vary amongst the communities also. My guess is they probably don't.
Probably
do you have
don't.
Those figures?
They probably don't. You know what I think does vary is hospice care and long-term care. You know, we might have some different delivery models in these different communities that might contribute to this.
Have you attempted to look at these differences and try to relay those to mortality and morbidity?
Not this particular one, no.
It would seem possible to do that.
It certainly would.
And it would be something I'd love to see you come back with at a later time, if
okay.
you could possibly do that, if you could make that arrangement. The importance of this, I think most of us grasp, is that the difference in the cost here is incredible.
Each ICU day is probably $10,000.
And if you put that over a large population, and considering that some of these populations are larger than others, I would especially worry about Portland and Eugene and Salem. This is not only a matter of number of days per person, but there's a vastly larger number of people there. This is a big city versus a small city. And this kind of variation in care really has no logical sequence to it, unless there is a huge difference in mortality and morbidity.
Much of it does not have an explanation. Much of it does. Some of it does. Some of it has an explanation around what's the delivery system look like. What's the practice system look like? What are the resources that are available? I think...
And the only outliers I can see that might change this would be Portland and Eugene getting referrals in from other areas that might affect their figures. And those referrals would be as... a different population of sicker individuals, but I assume you've washed those out, probably.
Chairman Bates, that's an incredibly important part about doing this kind of work, is that you have to do appropriate risk adjusting to take into account the differences in the population. I think what I would like to... I really did just pick one out of hundreds.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Representative, we're my friends here today. That's very nice. I'll ask you the kind of question I've asked you before, as you know. This is about the last 6 months of life. And I had an experience, as you know, about 18 months ago, where it could have been the last 6 months of life. It turned out not to be for a variety of reasons, one of which I think was the health care that I received. And other people here have had that same experience. Have you ever seen this done starting from the population of people with like diagnoses and circumstances who... for whom that period might have been the last 6 months of life, but wasn't?
I have not. People have. If we could predict which was the last 6 months of life with accuracy, we could save a lot of money.
That's exactly my point. You can predict it on a post-facto basis. You can go back and find the similar population for whom those same diagnoses, the same stage of disease, for which it could, in fact, have been the last 6 months of life, but turned out not to be. And one of the sources of this variation, and it comes from, I mean, these are 100% mortality, so you can't use mortality data. One of the sources of variation is that those people in some of those populations might have had a much higher proportion of them because of the expensive medical care and ended up not being the last 6 months of life. And it seems to me we're always talking about this variation in the last 6 months of life without really talking about those people came from a universe of folks for whom it might have been the last 6 months of life but turned out not to be. And there's the strange possibility that the intensity of medical care might have had something to do with that. Why not?
That's the point I'm driving to, that we need mortality and morbidity figures for this population.
Well, we have mortality for that population.
The population they came from. And if we go forward with reform and we actually do produce a board that looks at these kind of things, they have to be able to take action on this if what they're seeing is real. They have to find out why the practices in Bend, if the mortality and morbidity are the same, are so much better than other areas, and have to have a way of changing that.
Chairman,
I would guess the reason those figures are different is not because of anything we've talked about, but it's because of physician practices.
Chairman Bates, Representative Greenlick, I think one of the things that I like to remind folks when we look at quality data is what this does is help you start asking the questions. They aren't necessarily the answers, but they help you say, where is the variation, why does it exist, and what are the best practices and how do we disseminate them? So every question, I think, brings on more questions, but we're getting a much more sophisticated ability to do that if we have the resources to do that.
I find myself a little sensitive about this because I find myself a part of two groups now. One, that 10% that use 60% of the healthcare services, and the other people who could have potentially been in the last 6 months, it turned out not to be. So, I mean, it takes a different perspective.
Well, I have to share a personal experience as the caregiver for my 92-year-old father. I authorized treatment for cancer, oncology, and he's about 2 months from making the 2-year cutoff, and I'm really glad because that means that all that expense won't be in the last 2 years of his life either. So it's hard. These are difficult challenges.
I'm sorry to delay you. Go ahead and move forward.
I'm pleased to follow whatever you're interested in. You guys are really up on your data. I'm really nervous about really putting this one up here. You're going to grill me. I know on this one a lot. But this is to get across the idea that high quality can cost less. I think a lot of people have the assumption that high quality costs more. And I just want to show this scattergram that everything above the line is high quality and everything below the line is the lower quality, and things to the left of the vertical red line are higher cost and things to the right are lower cost. So you can see you can have plenty of practices. Each of these little symbols is a number of providers, and this is just one example in coronary care. You can have plenty of examples where high quality and low cost go together. You can have plenty of examples when high cost and low quality, all the quadrants are filled. And I just want to dispel the notion that if higher quality is going to cost more. And I think we can think about sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't, and how do we make those two go together. I'd like to just talk briefly about sort of a model for where I think transparency fits in a health policy framework. I like to think that some of it starts with, at the very top, when we talk about collaboration among the different stakeholders, and we usually refer to purchasers, to the providers, to the plans, and to the patients. They have to work together around this. Jointly, they can look at doing a shared data and performance measurement approach. And you have to do it in a shared way so that you have an apples-to-apples kind of comparison. And then we put the window on. This is the transparency part. It's who's going to see this information. And we like to think of it in three categories, that we have to do the consumer part that Dr. Hibbert just talked about. How do you get consumers engaged? This is very important for getting them involved in their own care. It gets them, I think, a very important thing that we didn't talk about earlier. It gets them talking to their clinicians about quality. Which hospital should I go to? Why are we different here in my community compared to other communities? The second group we need to think about looks at this data are the providers themselves, and this is really, really important. I think the people who go to medical school are very competitive. They want to do a good job, and I think by showing them the information, showing them how they rate relative to their peers, they're almost always surprised because they thought they were doing a really good job on this, or they, and sometimes it confirms that they are, and sometimes it confirms that they're not, and it gives them an opportunity to look at their fellow clinicians and say, what's working, what's not, and how can I improve? And then the third piece that I think the transparency is so important on is we've got to align the benefits. We've got to align the cost incentives to go with this kind of performance measurement. And this is going to be hard. I think our first forays into pay-for-performance are pretty sketchy. They're not as well developed as they need to be. But we know we need to find a way to pay for the kind of care that we want. And so measurement is going to be an important part of how do you actually do this next piece, which is to redesign the delivery system. How do we get a good focus on primary care? How do we make sure that we're encouraging physicians to hire a social worker or to hire a nurse for case management or to do the kind of outreach that can have real improvement in outcomes? And right now there's no reimbursement for that. And so moving toward a measurement system that lets us look at that, I think, is very important for moving it to better quality and lower cost. And then, of course, that can help with our access issue.
May I? Yes. It's interesting, the quality of care provided to people who are indigent. I know you can pay for quality, or you can pay a lot of money for what you think is quality, but how do you guarantee quality in the clinics, and do we look at that? I mean, you know, there might be a huge disparity, and maybe not, in terms of the quality. I suspect that a lot of people who work in clinics, who volunteer their time in clinics, give excellent quality. But I think that's going to be one of the things we look at, because if you get a free card under our universal plan, where do you go? You probably go to a clinic, or there are other, but to make sure the quality is consistent throughout the system.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morissette, yes, I assume you're talking about sort of safety net clinics, the clinics that serve low income.
Well, whatever we come up with as the provider for the people who get the card because they can't afford to pay money. Mm-hmm. And that would probably be in clinics. Maybe not. I don't know.
Questions?
Yeah. I think it's, yes, Senator Morissette, I think it's very important that we do measure quality in an apples-to-apples way across all of our provider networks, those that serve low-income, those that serve mainstream paying commercial population. I think that in my experience with our experiments around measurement, we find a lot of surprises. People assume that the care is lower quality in these places that serve the low-income. And, in fact, I've had some anecdotes told to me by physicians who say we were totally surprised, you know, that clinic is doing the best. And part of the reason they're doing the best is that they've reframed their thinking to a population kind of thinking. They've gotten the kind of you know, people who can do language translations in-house. They've gotten some nurses that are going to work with folks. They've redesigned their delivery system in order to meet their population's need. That was a perfect example of when you shine a light on two clinics, you get some surprises, you start asking questions, and you say, so how do we get the best results across the board?
May I just add something? My feeling in as we design this plan, we have to start with the clinics that are on the ground providing the care, and make sure that they are involved in anything that we do. And I agree with you that that is where some of the best care is probably given.
Questions?
Just a comment then for me as someone who actually is on the ground dealing with patients. What we have now for the most part is that occasionally you will see an insurer or other come to the office, do a chart review, and pick certain things they're looking for as far as what's been done for that patient population. They'll look at 10 or 15 charts. Each year they come from different companies, ask different things. There's no consistency what they're looking for, and no consistency in each record they look at also. So one doctor's office has one record system, one another. And you get some very fragmented and anecdotal evidence really out of this. You don't get good information. And because of that, I think providers look at these more as inspections that they go through and pretty well ignore what's given to them and rarely make any significant change. And, you know, you look at it and say, well, these people don't know what they're talking about anyway. Some gosh darn nurse came through here and throw it away. We need a way of systemically and on a regular basis coming through clinics and giving that information. And again, I'll refer back to an overall system that does that on a regular basis. And it's consistent. You know what you're expecting for outcomes, and you try to measure those outcomes, because when it gets measured, it gets fixed. If you're not measuring, you don't fix it. And I think a lot of it would happen very, on almost a voluntary basis if that would occur. But it may take some transparency there, too. And I think that would be something, even on the clinic basis, it might be very important to have.
Chairman Bates, that's exactly what we're trying to do. So thank you for that lead-in.
Don't start my office.
If I could follow with what is the Quality Corp trying to do about this? We are a nonprofit. We're multi-stakeholder, and we're working on better collaborative through a collaborative approach to better measurement so that we solve that problem that you're talking about, a fragmented measurement that doesn't mean anything and doesn't help. We also are very engaged in health information exchange, but I understand you're talking about that next week, so I'm only going to talk about our first effort. I believe you talked about this on Monday. You looked at some of other states. This is happens to be Minnesota. They use a STAR system, which I think Professor Hibbard would approve of as being interpretable. The one on the right in Maine, they use a blue ribbon process. But these are, you can go in there, you can click where you come from, and you can click your condition, and then you can get some information about the quality of the providers that are among your options for care. And that's sort of what we're headed toward from the Quality Corp's point of view. What we have done is we completed a pilot. And what we did with this pilot was we took data from 12 health plans. It was a mix of Medicaid and commercial. And we said, could we merge all of these? And instead of having the physician get a report one at a time in a different format on different subjects on a small number of patients, what if we merged all of those and just gave them a single report? We solved all the political problems. We got great cooperation from the health plans. We solved the legal problems. We figured out how to do this and be compliant with HIPAA. The technical problems were very, very challenging, but we did succeed in doing it. And physicians told us that on a scale of 1 to 10, the old way was a 2 and the new way was an 8. So the physicians liked it a lot better and said that this was a better way to work. So we've taken the next step. We said, what are the principles for going forward? How do we get past the pilot stage? And here's one that I think is very important as you think about how you're going to address transparency. We said that transparency and improvement need to go together. You can't just stick a measurement arm over here. You need to have the measurement arm very intimately engaged with how you're going to do the improvement. It affects the measurement. It affects the commitment of the folks that are involved. It affects how they use it and what you do.
They do.
We've also agreed on a first set of measurements. We brought physicians and health plans and consumers together to the table and said, you know, what are your priorities? Where should we start? And we've got a list of about 18 measures that everyone has agreed would be a good place to begin. And we're going to look at chronic disease and then a prevention measure. We've also agreed on a process for data collection, and we reached a compromise, or not a compromise, we reached a good solution that addresses what you were talking about earlier with Dr. Hibbard, which is we need to use different kinds of data. We can use claims data, you know, because we've got it, and it's available for all the physicians in the state, and that it's a good place to start, but it's not really the data we want. So some of the measures will come from claims data, but we want to accompany this with good clinical data that the physicians themselves produce. The trouble is not all clinicians can do this. You really need to be on an electronic health record or at least have a computerized disease management system if you're going to try to be able to do this. And this is also what you need in order to do good population care. So we know not all the clinicians will be able to do this right off, you know, coming out of the gate, but that's important to set the bar that we want to start having physicians do their own quality measurement and reporting that information. And then the third one is very important, which is the consumer's view of what's quality. What are they finding matters? And this is so important for making sure that we're dealing with issues around how do the patient and the physician interact? Does the patient understand what they were supposed to be doing? And are they going to go home now and in the next 3 months before they come back to the office be engaging in the kind of self-improvement behaviors that really are going to make the difference in their outcome more than what the physician does? So we've looked on that, on how would we go about getting all three of those kinds of data. And right now, guess where we are? We're trying to get an agreement on a funding strategy for how we would proceed with this. It's quite affordable, we think, if all of the health plans participate, and we're having conversations with them right now around how to do that. Last week on Thursday, I'm very delighted to say that the Quality Corporation received one of 10 new grants from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for aligning forces for quality improvement. We have 3 years now, and we are targeting the Willamette Valley. Our intervention will actually be statewide, but we're only committed to having performance measurements in the Willamette Valley because that's where we think we can really demonstrate and do the extra piece that you need to do to document your measurement. And what we have said is that we're going to have quality data publicly available for 90% of physicians for this process data that you can get from claims. And we've said that we're going to get the clinical data available for 50% of the physicians in the Willamette Valley, and we'll get the patient experience data publicly available for 30% of the providers in the next 3 years. It's a very ambitious goal. And this is what we have pledged as one of three things. And the second one that we have pledged is that we are going to align the technical assistance resources that are already available. We documented about $5 million that are going in from health plans, from public health, from physician groups, from malpractice insurers that are going to pilots to help clinicians do a better job. And we're going to do some work to align them to make sure that that's compatible with what we want to do with the measurement so that everybody's doing the measurement and working on improvement related to that. And then the third thing that we said we would do is we're going to talk to purchasers and consumers and help get them engaged in how to use this data. You were talking earlier about the consumers, and often the purchasers are their intermediary, and often they're the ones that are actually exercising the choice. So these are the three things that we have pledged to do for our Robert Wood Johnson grant.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes.
Am I really hearing you right? That's 90% of all physician practices in the Willamette Valley in 3 years?
Ambitious, isn't it?
Well, that's clean. That's
well,
clean.
Ambitious would be one way to suggest it.
That's fairly amazing. Will you be doing an attempt to, getting the data is important, but a measurement of improvement from before and after will be even more important. Is there any thought about doing that? As this data becomes available, that we then measure of this improvement afterwards?
Chairman Bates, Representative Greenlick, first you say this is ambitious, and then you say be even more ambitious.
Yes.
we know from our pilot that we can do this for 90% on claims data. You do algorithms, and you assign the patient to the physician, and in the Willamette Valley they aggregate in large enough groups through the independent practice associations that we think we can do this. The clinical data for the 50% is very ambitious. This is expecting the clinics to really get on board wanting to do this and wanting to do their own report. Part of the path to the 50% is mega groups like Permanente, that you have a lot of physicians that you can count, and that gets you a long way there. There are also some independent practice physicians groups that are very eager to do this. I want to be sure and emphasize, though, they are betting that there's going to be payment reform that will help encourage them to do this, that they are investing in information systems, they're investing in population-based approaches to care. They are expecting that they are going to shine when we start making this data available, that they're going to look very good, and that they're going to be a part of some sort of a new payment framework that will make this worth the investment.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Is LIPA involved?
Chairman Bates and Senator Morissette, yes, LIPA was very much involved in our pilot. They were one of the groups that submitted the data, and we expect them to want to participate.
Yes. Will this data be reported by physician, by practice, by some other aggregate? What level of detail?
The agreement is that the public reporting will be at the clinic level. We have some work to do to figure out what's a clinic. Is it a physical location or is it a practice group? But it will be available at the individual physician level within the clinics themselves. The medical directors from the clinics have said, this is what we want. We want to know the data on our own providers and how we're doing, and so that we can actually do improvement. This approach is a little different than, what Minnesota did, which does not get down at that individual detail level. But what we've heard from the clinicians, if you don't do the extra work to make it really available at this detail, it's not going to help. And they were not interested in just a report card in the sky. They were interested in a tool for improvement.
Sounds like I gave you a great segue there.
Frank. Thank you.
Senator Morse, I'm sorry.
No, it's Frank.
Okay.
It's after 6 o'clock.
Okay, good. Marchese will be right out. Okay.
Have you decided on the data that it is that you will be standardizing and collecting? Has that decision has already been made?
We've chosen 18 measures that we think would be appropriate. They come from a national data set called the Ambulatory Quality Alliance Starter Set that I'm pleased to say that at the national level they're getting their act together to say, let's standardize this and let's find a common way to do it. I think one of the big drivers for this is that the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare is about to do this too, and this is getting everyone's attention, and I think our provider networks are saying, you know, we'd rather be a part of doing this ourselves than having it done to us, and I think that's creating quite a motivation to do this.
Pay for performance.
If I might just follow
Senator up, Morris, Frank,
and I'll quit because we need to go home sometime. But it seems to me that this whole process, unless it is internalized within all of these organizations and practices and hospitals, so that it becomes their standard to measure their own performance, and then it's reported out. Unless we can cross that threshold and actually have something that is useful and incorporated by the and used by the providers, we probably won't gain much. And I don't know how far down that road that you've gone with the folks you're working with, but that would be a very, very important.
Chairman Bates, Senator.
Yes, I'm done. Thank you.
Senator Morrison, Chairman Bates, yes, absolutely, that this is not going to work unless physicians buy into it. And we started with interviews with physician leaders around the community. Where are you? What do you think about this? We have made sure that we've had some town halls with physicians to talk about it. I would say that right now the enthusiasm is totally mixed, there are some that can't wait. They expect that this is a part of, as I said, payment reform, and they expect to do better from this. We have other physicians who are over my dead body. You can't measure quality. This is not cookbook. How dare you? So it's going to be a challenge, and we have to do this right. And I think one of the most critical things is to have a genuine multi-stakeholder approach that has the clinicians at the table helping make the decisions to figure out how we're going to do this and do it well. It's important for them to be at the table, though, and hear from consumers, hear from purchasers, hear from public policy people that we expect, this is what we expect.
Questions? Well, Mitch, you and I both know the God concept is still out there, but that doesn't mean some of us think we're gods.
And we're not. And that will be one of your challenges, I'm sure. But I would also suggest that you have pretty objective measurements. I can pick a couple off the top of my head that no one can really refute. I mean, how many A1Cs do you do in your patients, and what are those A1Cs, correct? I would guess that's one of them?
You bet. That's two
okay.
of them.
Okay. So, I mean, I can guess, and no one can refute those, really. So it will be an interesting project, and one which we look forward to seeing the results of. And if I'm not in the 2% or whatever it is, to die every 2 years, I'll be here to see it in 3 years, okay? All right.
And I think,
any other questions?
And I think it's important, even organizationally, to have a rich fantasy life.
Any other questions for Mrs. Clark? Thank you very much for your time this evening.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask the committee a question first.
Were you done?
Well, I was going to do a couple more, but...
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm not allowed to say.
No, I'm totally embarrassed. I apologize. I thought you had completed your study.
I would like to say, just take a moment to say, how do I think this relates to the work around reform, if I may? I think that the Quality Corp has a model that should fit in your ideal practice redesign, and I was asked to comment on that. And I think some of our strengths are that all the stakeholder groups are really present, and I think that matters a lot. We have buy-in from those that are being measured so that they do have a say, but they don't have the whole say, and I think that's important as you think about this. We combine reporting with multi-stakeholder use that will actually drive change. I think that's important. We're also lean and entrepreneurial. We're working on a very small budget to get this done, and we are getting it done for primary care. We have some gaps, though. We're only one piece of the picture. This is just primary care. Dr. Hibbert was talking about hospital data. Well, what about specialists? Well, what about other settings of care like long-term care? It's not going to work if this is just kind of all over the place and you have to figure out how to, you know, search the web to go find this information. I think it's very important as you think about your ideal and what you're headed toward is that we think about how do we consolidate this and make this useful for the consumer. We're also not accountable to the community. We're accountable to the stakeholders, and we have very insecure funding, and that should worry you. that
is worry you.
It does. That as you think about should some public resources be in here to make this a more stable process, to keep it secure and to make sure that it is beholden to the public and not necessarily just to the delivery system. So what I think Oregon needs, what the Quality Corp thinks Oregon needs, you saw this on your slides on Monday, the Oregon Health Policy Commission talks about creating a collaborative structure to improve the collection, measurement, and public reporting of that information, and that it should be a public-private entity trusted by all the stakeholders. So if I can, one more thing, I think that if you do this, crystal clear definition of what it is you want done. Charter both the reporting measure and the improvement together. Make sure that you have a well-balanced, accountable leadership group. Make sure that you have stable funding. And I would strongly recommend some sort of external validating entity that reports to the legislature what the return on investment is for all of this work. Healthcare quality varies. Higher quality care is not more expensive. We need apples and apples transparency. It's the foundation for provider improvement. It's the foundation for patients seeking care. And it's the foundation for purchasers creating incentives. And Oregon needs an adequately funded, accountable public-private entity to coordinate quality measurement and reporting. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here.
And I apologize for cutting you off. I didn't realize you hadn't finished.
Mr. Chair.
Are you sure that you're finished?
I'm sure I'm finished. Thank you, Senator Bates.
Yes. I don't want to hear this, Senator Wessel, but I'm going to anyway.
Before I mean you so rudely. Just a couple of detailed questions. At the very bottom, we've got Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation, and then what's that small language that nobody can read underneath quality?
Oh, a nonprofit partnership for quality improvement.
And how long have you been in existence?
We were created in 2001. In 2003, we got our first executive director, who was Vicki Gates, who was here Monday night. And we got our first serious money in 2004. And I've been here for the last 2 years.
Well, I just want to thank you and Judy and Vicki and everyone involved in the transparency and quality connection. We've given two precious nights of our limited committee time to this issue. We see it as a very significant variable in the equation to equating to healthcare, successful healthcare reform, and we very much appreciate you both coming up. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Chairman Leslie.
Thank you. Any further questions?
One. In looking at the definition of stakeholders, including consumers, government, employers, providers, health plans must be involved. If we miss any providers, would you let us know, please? There are a lot of people who are providers of health care. And we recognize some as, and we don't recognize others, but if we're going to have a comprehensive plan and we're going to contact all of our providers, that's, to me, is one of the difficulties, is knowing who they are. And if you see someone that we're missing, let us know.
Definitely, Chairman Bates and Senator Morse, I agree with you completely. We have to think very broadly about what provider means. And look forward to doing that with you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any further questions? I know we spent a lot of time on transparency and quality, but they're important, I believe, because the real issue before us is not really universal access to health care. That will come if we drive down cost. If we don't drive down cost, no matter what system we put together, we will not have that. And so being able to look at these issues, and we spend a lot of time on them, is the only way I think we'll get to cost and quality at the same time. It's going to be a long, long slog to do that. At the present time, the healthcare industry, I don't believe we spend more than a minuscule amount of a huge amount of money
on these issues, and it has to change. And any system we put together is going to have, as a component of it, a significant amount of resources spent on just this issue on a continuing long-term basis. Otherwise, we'll never get there. So I really appreciate your testimony, and I thank you.
Mr. Chair, while we're talking about those sort of things, the other thing that we spend a minuscule amount in the healthcare industry is R&D and self-improvement. And a piece of what we heard both from Nancy and Judy tonight are fruits of research and development. And we, and one of the things that we really need to look at is if we're going to be talking about every one of the proposals we have talks about basic change in the health delivery system, one of the things we need to look at is the extent to try and create system improvement R&D built right into the system as a part of our ongoing activities. And it's, I mean, both of what we heard today came out of a relatively long history of R&D funded sort of independently, and where the Quality Commission is going is some more R&D funding from external, but we don't invest anything in our of our own in that, and it's something that we really do need to be looking at.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, we've seen some work done by Care Oregon, by this group. It's in comparison to the entire universe of health and dentists, the entire universe of healthcare dollars, it's nothing. And then we're surprised that we have a system that does not produce the quality we want and is incredibly expensive. So this really goes to the heart of any system we put together. I'm going to ask the committee for one question. Is there any stakeholder group we have not heard from you specifically want to hear from about transparency? I know you have one group we've got scheduled in March. Any others? If not, we may not be coming back to this in the near future, so I just want to offer that to us.
Can I say something?
Yes.
The group that we have scheduled is 100% access from Lane County. That's a good group.
Thank you.
And we are working on some transparency issues in the House committee.
In the last 5 minutes here, I want to talk about two things. One, I'm not going to ask us to look into the principles for the committee tonight. We haven't got time to do that. I'd like to have you take this home and look at it. Senator Morris has given us another piece to put into this. I'd like to take a look at that, too. It's concerning medical malpractice and defensive medicine. And we'll bring that up in the next meeting and try to get that done. I would like to open up the last 5 minutes for discussion of where this committee is going and how we're going to get where we're going to go.
Oh, in 5 minutes?
In 5 minutes. It's going to be about process. We are, thank you. We're going to try to set aside a half an hour in each meeting now to talk about where the rubber really meets the road. Starting to talk about the structure of a new healthcare system. We'll be looking at the three or four proposals we have in front of us and analyzing those starting on Monday night. And we'll be beginning to look at Senate Bill 329 of where we want to go with that and what some of those structures look like inside that. What the board would look like if we decide to go there. What a pool would look like if we decide to go there. That's the discussion we need to open up. We've been here now for almost a month. And I and many others are feeling a little frustrated that while we're looking at some good stuff and we're hearing over again the things you've heard many times before from many of us, others maybe not, but it's time to move forward while we're doing that with more structure to the program. Senator Weston?
Mitch? I just wanted to comment that I think that's a very important thing to do. And I suggest we use the first 30 minutes, not the last 30 minutes for it.
The only reason I say that is that the only time we have invited testimony, I'm not sure those people want to stay and listen to that, but maybe they'd be the most important thing that happened that night for them, too. And considering the condition of some of our members, I think you may have a good point.
I think there's just more energy in the first.
I will take that as, we will take that as suggestion. No one disagrees. Sure. We'll do that.
It depends on how bad I've been beat up in Senator Morissette's committee before we get here. So,
but Senator Morissette, I'm asking for a little laxity here for some of the members that don't have to go to the second half of the game. Senator Morris.
This is a process question, Mr. Chair. As we go along, we've heard some things here today that appropriately could amend into the bill. How would you like to see this happen in terms of things that emerge? And one member may think of something, another member may not, but let's kind of start developing some hooks for things that we'd like to have Rick move into another stage of actually introducing those amendments.
And I do think of it that way. And, you know, I've often used the phrase that we're actually going to have to weave this together to make the cloth of a healthcare system. Every thread's going to be important, what those threads are, what color they are, how we put that weave together is important. And we may pull some threads out and put a different thread in as we go along. We're going to have to do sort of in a parallel way. We'll be taking testimony and issues that we may already have thought we made a decision on, but be ready to go back and reconsider that decision or that thing we've hung up and say that isn't quite what we wanted. We want this instead. It'll be very fluid. But I think just waiting and taking testimony for 3 months and then trying to do a bill is not appropriate. We need to work along towards the system starting next week. And I think it'll be very frustrating for us to sit here at this time of night with wonderful people coming in giving us great testimony, but not putting any, what we often call, meat on the bones. We've got to start moving this thing along.
Mr. Chair, I'd agree with what Senator Moore said to a degree, because when we start getting into details, I'm sure many of us will have alternative ideas or suggestions, but I would suggest at this point, knowing what's going on down the hall, that we just bring all those to Rick and we kind of have a repository, and so at some point we can kind of look at all, rather than have every idea everybody has be drafted as an amendment. I don't think that's appropriate at this point in time, and just bring them to Rick and let's get them in appropriate language, and so we have them kind of in a parking lot as we move forward.
I agree. We're looking for really a single bill to come out of this committee. And to do that, we'll bring all these threads together. Your point's well taken. I'm not interested in amendment after amendment after amendment.
Well, and that speaks to our last committee, because that, you know, we've had amendments that we brought over 2 years. So.
And some we shouldn't have. So
a different problem.
Jeff is the problem. You know, let me put a point on this. Several of you have heard me say multiple times that I know you are getting just as tired as I am of sitting around the same tables, looking at the same people, discussing the same problem, and not solving anything. That time is now over. We are starting to move, and move rapidly. If you have ideas, concerns, issues, Rick Rakovian is going to be the collator of those.
24/7.
Yeah, here's his personal cell phone and home phone. Here's the point. The point is, and it's why I asked Judy the question, you know, early on, how long have we been talking about some of these quality and transparency measures? For as long as we've been talking about health care reform. If someone doesn't force an action and call the question, we will be here in 10 years struggling with all of the same issues we struggle with today and have been for a decade, fully well knowing the problems and the issues and most of the solutions. It is time. Thank you so very, very much for coming and your continued. We need you all. We all need each other. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. And I will say that we will be still cutting some bait, but we're going to start to go fishing.
Yeah.
Okay. Can I have a closing word?
Yes, Rick.
In the
we're talking about 24/7.
24. In the passing the buck as well. Atlanta Weinbaum is still the point person.
And her cell phone number.
Her
is.
Cell phone. So as we collect information, I'm going to probably defer to her. Could actually be the first line of collection, and then we are working together to make sure it's all kind of aggregated well.
Here's your first note. Make it happen.
Rick, I'll give you some points for that. That's one of the fastest handoffs I've ever seen of a hot potato in my life. I don't think you can get your fingers warm, let alone burn on that. Alana, we'll look forward to working with you more. All right. Thank you. Thank you for coming this evening. I know it's late, and I know these evenings will continue to be late, but thank you very much, and we'll look forward to seeing you in the future. Thank you.
Darn it.